This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Paper Towns by John Green, performed by Dan John Miller.
Dedication to Julie Strauss Gable, without whom none of this could have become real.
And after, when we went outside to look at her finished lantern from the road, I said I liked the way her light shone through the face that flickered in the dark. Jack-o'-lantern. Katrina Vandenberg from Atlas. People say friends don't destroy one another. What do they know about friends? Game shows touch our lives. The Mountain Goats. Prologue. The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. Like, I will probably never be struck by lightning, or win a Nobel Prize, or become the dictator of a small nation in the Pacific Islands, or contract terminal ear cancer, or spontaneously combust. But if you consider all the unlikely things together, at least one of them will probably happen to each of us. I could have seen it rain frogs. I could have stepped foot on Mars. I could have been eaten by a whale. I could have married the Queen of England, or survived months at sea. But my miracle was different. My miracle was this. Out of all the houses, in all the subdivisions, in all of Florida, I ended up living next door to Margot Roth Spiegelman. Our subdivision, Jefferson Park, used to be a Navy base. But then the Navy didn't need it anymore, so it returned the land to the citizens of Orlando, Florida, who decided to build a massive subdivision, because that's what Florida does with land. My parents and Margot's parents ended up moving next door to one another just after the first houses were built. Margot and I were too. Before Jefferson Park was a Pleasantville, and before it was a Navy base, it belonged to an actual Jefferson. This guy, Dr. Jefferson Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson Jefferson has a school named after him in Orlando, and also a large charitable foundation. But the fascinating and unbelievable but true thing about Dr. Jefferson Jefferson is that he was not a doctor of any kind. He was just an orange juice salesman named Jefferson Jefferson. When he became rich and powerful, he went to court, made Jefferson his middle name, and then changed his first name to Doctor. Capital D, lowercase r, period. So Margot and I were nine. Our parents were friends, so we would sometimes play together, biking past the cul-de-sac streets to Jefferson Park itself, the hub of our subdivision's wheel. I always got very nervous whenever I heard that Margot was about to show up on account of how she was the most fantastically gorgeous creature that God had ever created. On the morning in question, she wore white shorts and a pink t-shirt that featured a green dragon breathing a fire of orange glitter. It is difficult to explain how awesome I found this t-shirt at the time. Margot, as always, biked standing up, her arms locked as she leaned above the handlebars, her purple sneakers a circuitous blur. It was a steam-hot day in March. The sky was clear, but the air tasted acidic, like it might storm later. At the time, I fancied myself an inventor, and after we locked up our bikes and began the short walk across the park to the playground, I told Margot about an idea I had for an invention called the Ringolator. The Ringolator was a gigantic cannon that would shoot big colored rocks into a very low orbit, giving Earth the same sort of rings that Saturn has. I still think this would be a fine idea, but it turns out that building a cannon that can shoot boulders into a low orbit is fairly complicated. I'd been in this park so many times before that it was mapped in my mind, so we were only a few steps inside when I began to sense that the world was out of order, even though I couldn't immediately figure out what was different. "Quentin," Margot said, quietly, calmly. She was pointing, and then I realized what was different. There was a live oak a few feet ahead of us, thick and gnarled and ancient-looking. That was not new. The playground on our right, not new either. But now a guy wearing a gray suit slumped against the trunk of the oak tree, not moving. This was new. He was encircled by blood, A half-dried fountain of it poured out of his mouth. The mouth open in a way that mouths generally shouldn't be. Flies at rest on his pale forehead. "He's dead," Margot said, as if I couldn't tell. I took two small steps backward. I remember thinking that if I made any sudden movements, he might wake up and attack me. Maybe he was a zombie. I knew zombies weren't real, but he sure looked like a potential zombie. As I took those two steps back, Margot took two equally small and quiet steps forward.
"His eyes are open," she said.
"We gotta go home," I said.
"I thought you closed your eyes when you died," she said.
"Margot, we gotta go home and tell." She took another step. She was close enough now to reach out and touch his foot.
"What do you think happened to him?" she asked. "Maybe it was drugs or something."
I didn't want to leave Margot alone with the dead guy who might be an attack zombie, but I also didn't care to stand around and chat about the circumstances of his demise. I gathered my courage and stepped forward to take her hand.
"Margot, we gotta go right now."
"Okay, yeah," she said. We ran to our bikes, my stomach churning with something that felt exactly like excitement, but wasn't. We got on our bikes and I let her go in front of me because I was crying and didn't want her to see. I could see blood on the soles of her purple sneakers. His blood. The dead guy blood. And then we were back home in our separate houses. My parents called 911, and I heard the sirens in the distance and asked to see the fire trucks, but my mom said no. Then I took a nap. Both my parents are therapists, which means that I am really goddamned well-adjusted. So when I woke up, I had a long conversation with my mom about the cycle of life and how death is part of life, but not a part of life I needed to be particularly concerned about at the age of 9, and I felt better. Honestly, I never worried about it much, which is saying something, because I can do some worrying. Here's the thing. I found a dead guy. Little, adorable, 9-year-old me, and my even littler and more adorable playdate found a guy with blood pouring out of his mouth, and that blood was on her little adorable sneakers as we biked home. It's all very dramatic and everything, but so what? I didn't know the guy. People I don't know die all the damn time. If I had a nervous breakdown every time something awful happened in the world, I'd be crazier than a shithouse rat. That night, I went into my room at 9 o'clock to go to bed, because 9 o'clock was my bedtime. My mom tucked me in, told me she loved me, and I said, "See you tomorrow." And she said, "See you tomorrow." And then she turned out the lights and closed the door almost all the way. As I turned on my side, I saw Margot Roth Spiegelman standing outside my window, her face almost pressed against the screen. I got up and opened the window, but the screen stayed between us, pixelating her.
"I did an investigation," she said quite seriously.
Even up close, the screen broke her face apart, but I could tell that she was holding a little notebook and a pencil with teeth marks around the eraser. She glanced down at her notes.
"Mrs. Feldman from over on Jefferson Court said his name was Robert Joyner. She told me he lived on Jefferson Road in one of those condos on top of the grocery store. So I went over there, and there were a bunch of policemen, and one of them asked if I worked at the school paper, and I said our school didn't have a paper, and he said as long as I wasn't a journalist, he would answer my questions. He said Robert Joyner was 36 years old, a lawyer. They wouldn't let me in the apartment, but a lady named Juanita Alvarez lives next door to him, and I got into her apartment by asking if I could borrow a cup of sugar, and then she said that Robert Joyner had killed himself with a gun, and then I asked why, and then she told me that he was getting a divorce and was sad about it."
She stopped then, and I just looked at her, her face gray and moonlit and split into a thousand little pieces by the weave of the window screen. Her wide, round eyes flitted back and forth from her notebook to me.
"Lots of people get divorces and don't kill themselves," I said.
"I know," she said, excitement in her voice.
"That's what I told Juanita Alvarez. And then she said,"
Margot flipped the notebook page,
"she said that Mr. Joyner was troubled, and then I asked what that meant, and then she told me that we should just pray for him, and that I needed to take the sugar to my mom, and I said forget the sugar and left."
I said nothing again. I just wanted her to keep talking. That small voice, tense with the excitement of almost knowing things, making me feel like something important was happening to me.
"I think I maybe know why," she finally said.
"Why?"
"Maybe all the strings inside him broke," she said.
While I tried to think of something to say in answer to that, I reached forward and pressed the lock on the screen between us, dislodging it from the window. I placed the screen on the floor, but she didn't give me a chance to speak. Before I could sit back down, she just raised her face up toward me and whispered,
"Shut the window."
So I did. I thought she would leave, but she just stood there, watching me. I waved at her and smiled, but her eyes seemed fixed on something behind me, something monstrous that had already drained the blood from her face, and I felt too afraid to turn around to see. But there was nothing behind me, of course, except maybe the dead guy. I stopped waving. My head was level with hers as we stared at each other from opposite sides of the glass. I don't remember how it ended, if I went to bed or she did. In my memory, it doesn't end. We just stay there, looking at each other, forever. Margot always loved mysteries, and in everything that came afterward, I could never stop thinking that maybe she loved mysteries so much that she became one. Part 1. The Strings. Chapter 1. The longest day of my life began tardily. I woke up late, took too long in the shower, and ended up having to enjoy my breakfast in the passenger seat of my mom's minivan at 7:17 that Wednesday morning. I usually got a ride to school with my best friend, Ben Starling, but Ben had gone to school on time, making him useless to me. On time, for us, was 30 minutes before school actually started, because the half hour before the first bell was the highlight of our social calendars. Standing outside the side door that led into the band room and just talking. Most of my friends were in band, and most of my free time during school was spent within 20 feet of the band room. But I was not in the band, because I suffer from the kind of tone deafness that is generally associated with actual deafness. I was going to be 20 minutes late, which technically meant that I'd still be 10 minutes early for school itself. As she drove, Mom was asking me about classes and finals and prom.
"I don't believe in prom,"
I reminded her as she rounded a corner. I expertly angled my Raisin Bran to accommodate the G-forces. I'd done this before.
"Well, there's no harm in just going with a friend. I'm sure you could ask Cassie Heine."
And I could have asked Cassie Heine, who was actually perfectly nice and pleasant and cute, despite having a fantastically unfortunate last name.
"It's not just that I don't like prom. I also don't like people who like prom," I explained,
although this was, in point of fact, untrue. Ben was absolutely gaga over the idea of going. Mom turned into school, and I held the mostly empty bowl with both hands as we drove over a speed bump. I glanced over at the senior parking lot. Margot Roth-Spiegelman's silver Honda was parked in its usual spot. Mom pulled the minivan into a cul-de-sac outside the band room and kissed me on the cheek. I could see Ben and my other friends standing in a semicircle. I walked up to them, and the half-circle effortlessly expanded to include me. They were talking about my ex-girlfriend, Susie Chung, who played cello and was apparently creating quite a stir by dating a baseball player named Taddy Mac. Whether this was his given name, I did not know, but at any rate, Susie had decided to go to prom with Taddy Mac, another casualty.
"Bro,"
said Ben, standing across from me. He nodded his head and turned around. I followed him out of the circle and through the door. A small, olive-skinned creature who had hit puberty but never hit it very hard, Ben had been my best friend since fifth grade, when we both finally owned up to the fact that neither of us was likely to attract anyone else as a best friend. Plus, he tried hard, and I liked that, most of the time.
"How you doing?"
I asked. We were safely inside, everyone else's conversations making ours inaudible.
"Radar is going to prom,"
he said morosely. Radar was our other best friend. We called him Radar because he looked like a little bespectacled guy called Radar on this old TV show, MASH, except, one, The TV radar wasn't black, and, two, at some point after the nicknaming, our radar grew about 6 inches and started wearing contacts, so I suppose that, three, he actually didn't look like the guy on MASH at all, but, four, with 3.5 weeks left of high school, we weren't very well going to re-nickname him. That girl Angela? I asked. Radar never told us anything about his love life, but this did not dissuade us from frequent speculation. Ben nodded and then said,
"Yeah, you know my big plan to ask a fresh bunny to prom because they're the only girls who don't know the bloody Ben story?"
I nodded.
"Well," Ben said, "this morning some darling little ninth grade honey bunny came up to me and asked me if I was bloody Ben. And I began to explain that it was a kidney infection and she giggled and ran away. So that's out."
In 10th grade, Ben was hospitalized for a kidney infection, but Becca Arrington, Margot's best friend, started a rumor that the real reason he had blood in his urine was due to chronic masturbation. Despite its medical implausibility, this story had haunted Ben ever since. "That sucks," I said. Ben started outlining plans for finding a date, but I was only half listening because through the thickening mass of humanity crowding the hallway, I could see Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was next to her locker, standing beside her boyfriend, Jace. She wore a white skirt to her knees and a blue print top. I could see her collarbone. She was laughing at something hysterical, her shoulders bent forward, her big eyes crinkling at their corners, her mouth open wide. But it didn't seem to be anything Jace had said, because she was looking away from him, across the hallway to a bank of lockers. I followed her eyes and saw Becca Arrington draped all over some baseball player like she was an ornament and he a Christmas tree. I smiled at Margot, even though I knew she couldn't see me.
"Bro, you should just hit that. Forget about Jace. God, that is one candy-coated honey bunny."
As we walked, I kept taking glances at her through the crowd, quick snapshots, a photographic series entitled "Perfection Stands Still While Mortals Walk Past." As I got closer, I thought maybe she wasn't laughing after all. Maybe she'd received a surprise or a gift or something. She couldn't seem to close her mouth.
"Yeah,"
I said to Ben, still not listening, still trying to see as much of her as I could without being too obvious. It wasn't even that she was so pretty. She was just so awesome, and in the literal sense. And then we were too far past her, too many people walking between her and me, and I never even got close enough to hear her speak or understand whatever the hilarious surprise had been. Ben shook his head because he had seen me see her 1,000 times, and he was used to it.
"Honestly, she's hot, but she's not that hot. You know who's seriously hot?"
"Who?" I asked.
"Lacey,"
he said, who was Margot's other best friend.
"Also, your mom. Bro, I saw your mom kiss you on the cheek this morning. And forgive me, but I swear to God, I was like, man, I wish I was cute. And also, I wish my cheeks had penises."
I elbowed him in the ribs, but I was still thinking about Margot, because she was the only legend who lived next door to me. Margot Roth Spiegelman, whose six-syllable name was often spoken in its entirety with a kind of quiet reverence. Margot Roth Spiegelman, whose stories of epic adventures would blow through school like a summer storm. An old guy living in a broken-down house in Hot Coffee, Mississippi, taught Margot how to play the guitar. Margot Roth Spiegelman, who spent 3 days traveling with the circus. They thought she had potential on the trapeze. Margot Roth Spiegelman, who drank a cup of herbal tea with the Mullionaires backstage after a concert in St. Louis while they drank whiskey. Margot Roth Spiegelman, who got into that concert by telling the bouncer she was the bassist's girlfriend, and didn't they recognize her? And come on, guys, seriously, my name is Margot Roth Spiegelman, and if you go back there and ask the bassist to take one look at me, he will tell you that I either am his girlfriend or he wishes I was. And then the bouncer did so, and then the bassist said, "Yeah, that's my girlfriend, let her in the show." And then later the bassist wanted to hook up with her, and she rejected the bassist from the Mullionaires. The stories, when they were shared, inevitably ended with, "I mean, can you believe it?" We often could not, but they always proved true. And then we were at our lockers. Radar was leaning against Ben's locker, typing into a handheld device. "So you're going to prom," I said to him. He looked up and then looked back down.
I'm de-vandalizing the Omnictionary article about a former prime minister of France. Last night someone deleted the entire entry and then replaced it with a sentence, Jacques Chirac is a gay, which as it happens is incorrect both factually and grammatically.
Radar is a big-time editor of this online user-created reference source called Omnictionary. His whole life is devoted to the maintenance and well-being of Omnictionary. This was but one of several reasons why his having a prom date was somewhat surprising. So you're going to prom, I repeated.
Sorry,
he said without looking up. It was a well-known fact that I was opposed to prom. Absolutely nothing about any of it appealed to me. Not slow dancing, not fast dancing, not the dresses, and definitely not the rented tuxedo. Renting a tuxedo seemed to me an excellent way to contract some hideous disease from its previous tenant, and I did not aspire to become the world's only virgin with pubic lice.
Bro,
Ben said to Radar,
the fresh honeys know about the Bloody Ben story.
Radar put the handheld away finally and nodded sympathetically.
So anyway, Ben continued, my two remaining strategies are either to purchase a prom date on the internet or fly to Missouri and kidnap some nice corn-fed little honey bunny.
I had tried telling Ben that honey bunny sounded more sexist and lame than retro cool, but he refused to abandon the practice. He called his own mother a honey bunny. There was no fixing him.
I'll ask Angela if she knows anybody, Radar said. Although getting you a date to prom will be harder than turning lead into gold.
Getting you a date to prom is so hard that the hypothetical idea itself is actually used to cut diamonds, I added. Radar tapped the locker twice with his fist to express his approval and then came back with another.
Ben, getting you a date to prom is so hard that the American government believes the problem cannot be solved with diplomacy, but will instead require force.
I was trying to think of another one, when we all three simultaneously saw the human-shaped container of anabolic steroids known as Chuck Parson walking toward us with some intent. Chuck Parson did not participate in organized sports because to do so would distract from the larger goal of his life, to one day be convicted of homicide.
Hey, faggots,
he called. Chuck, I answered, as friendly as I could muster. Chuck hadn't given us any serious trouble in a couple of years. Someone in cool kidland laid down the edict that we were to be left alone, so it was a little unusual for him even to talk to us. Maybe because I spoke, and maybe not, he slammed his hands against the lockers on either side of me and then leaned in close enough for me to contemplate his toothpaste brand.
What do you know about Margot and Jace?
I said. I thought of everything I knew about them. Jace was Margot Roth Spiegelman's first and only serious boyfriend. They began dating at the tail end of last year. They were both going to University of Florida next year. Jace got a baseball scholarship there. He was never over at her house, except to pick her up. She never acted as if she liked him all that much, but then she never acted as if she liked anyone all that much. Nothing, I said finally.
Don't ship me around, he growled.
I barely even know her,
I said, which had become true. He considered my answer for a minute, and I tried hard to stare at his close-set eyes. He nodded very slightly, pushed off the lockers, and walked away to attend his first period class, the care and feeding of pectoral muscles. The second bell rang, 1 minute to class. Radar and I had calc. Ben had finite mathematics. The classrooms were adjacent. We walked toward them together, the three of us in a row, trusting that the tide of classmates would part enough to let us by, and it did. I said, getting you a date to prom is so hard that 1,000 monkeys typing at 1,000 typewriters for 1,000 years would never once type, I will go to prom with Ben. Ben could not resist tearing himself apart.
My prom prospects are so poor that Q's grandma turned me down. She said she was waiting for Radar to ask her.
Radar nodded his head slowly.
It's true, Q. Your grandma loves the brothers.
It was so pathetically easy to forget about Chuck, to talk about prom even though I didn't give a shit about prom. Such was life that morning. Nothing really mattered that much, not the good things and not the bad ones. We were in the business of mutual amusement, and we were reasonably prosperous. I spent the next 3 hours in classrooms, trying not to look at the clocks above various blackboards, and then looking at the clocks, and then being amazed that only a few minutes had passed since I last looked at the clock. I had had nearly 4 years of experience looking at these clocks, but their sluggishness never ceased to surprise. If I am ever told that I have one day to live, I will head straight for the hallowed halls of Winter Park High School, where a day has been known to last 1,000 years. But as much as it felt like third period physics would never end, it did, and then I was in the cafeteria with Ben. Radar had fifth period lunch with most of our other friends, so Ben and I generally sat together alone, a couple seats between us and a group of drama kids we knew. Today, we were both eating mini pepperoni pizzas. "Pizza's good," I said. He nodded distractedly. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"Nothing,"
he said through a mouthful of pizza. He swallowed.
"I know you think it's dumb, but I want to go to prom."
1. I do think it's dumb. 2. If you want to go, just go. 3. If I'm not mistaken, you haven't even asked anyone.
"I asked Cassie Heine during calc. I wrote her a note."
I raised my eyebrows questioningly. Ben reached into his shorts and slid a heavily folded piece of paper to me. I flattened it out.
"Ben, I'd love to go to prom with you, but I'm already going with Frank. Sorry. See."
I refolded it and slid it back across the table. I could remember playing paper football on these tables.
"That sucks," I said. "Yeah, whatever."
The walls of sound felt like they were closing in on us, and we were silent for a while, and then Ben looked at me very seriously and said,
"I'm going to get so much play in college. I'm going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records under the category Most Honey Bunnies Ever Pleased."
I laughed. I was thinking about how Radar's parents actually were in the Guinness Book when I noticed a pretty African-American girl with spiky little dreads standing above us. It took me a moment to realize that the girl was Angela, Radar's, I guess, girlfriend.
"Hi,"
she said to me. "Hey," I said. I had had classes with Angela and knew her a little, but we didn't say hello in the hallway or anything. I motioned for her to sit. She scooted a chair to the head of the table.
"I figured that you guys probably know Marcus better than anyone," she said, using Radar's real name.
She leaned toward us, her elbows on the table.
"It's a shitty job, but someone's got to do it,"
Ben answered, smiling.
"Do you think he's, like, embarrassed of me?"
Ben laughed.
"What? No," he said.
"Technically," I added, "you should be embarrassed of him." She rolled her eyes, smiling, a girl accustomed to compliments.
"But he's never, like, invited me to hang out with you, though."
"Oh," I said, getting it finally. "That's because he's embarrassed of us." She laughed.
"You seem pretty normal."
"You've never seen Ben snort Sprite up his nose and then spit it out of his mouth," I said.
"I look like a demented carbonated fountain," he deadpanned.
"But really, you wouldn't worry? I mean, we've been dating for 5 weeks, and he's never even taken me to his house."
Ben and I exchanged a knowing glance, and I scrunched up my face to suppress laughter.
"What?"
she asked.
"Nothing,"
I said. "Honestly, Angela, if he was forcing you to hang out with us and taking you to his house all the time..."
"Then it would definitely mean he didn't like you," Ben finished.
"Are his parents weird?"
I struggled with how to answer that question, honestly.
No, they're cool. They're just kind of overprotective, I guess."
"Yeah, overprotective,"
Ben agreed a little too quickly. She smiled and then got up, saying she had to go say hi to someone before lunch was over. Ben waited until she was gone to say anything.
"That girl is awesome," Ben said.
"I know," I answered. "I wonder if we can replace Radar with her."
"Yeah, she's probably not that good with computers, though. We need someone who's good at computers. Plus, I bet she sucks at Resurrection,"
which was our favorite video game.
"By the way," Ben added,
Nice call saying that Radar's folks are overprotective.
Well, it's not my place to tell her, I said.
I wonder how long till she gets to see the Team Radar residence and museum.
Ben smiled. The period was almost over, so Ben and I got up and put our trays onto the conveyor belt, the very same one that Chuck Parson had thrown me onto freshman year, sending me into the terrifying netherworld of Winter Park's dishwashing corps. We walked over to Radar's locker and were standing there when he raced up just after the first bell.
I decided during government that I would actually, literally, suck donkey balls if it meant I could skip that class for the rest of the semester, he said.
You can learn a lot about government from donkey balls, I said. Hey, speaking of reasons you wish you had fourth period lunch, we just dined with Angela. Ben smirked at Radar and said,
Yeah, she wants to know why she's never been over to your house.
Radar exhaled a long breath as he spun the combination to open his locker. He breathed for so long, I thought he might pass out.
Crap,
he said, finally. Are you embarrassed about something? I asked, smiling.
Shut up,
he answered, poking his elbow into my gut. You live in a lovely home, I said.
Seriously, bro, added Ben. She's a really nice girl. I don't see why you can't introduce her to your parents and show her Casa Radar.
Radar threw his books into his locker and shut it. The din of conversation around us quieted just a bit as he turned his eyes toward the heavens and shouted,
It is not my fault that my parents own the world's largest collection of black Santas.
I had heard Radar say the world's largest collection of black Santas perhaps 1,000 times in my life, and it never became any less funny to me. But he wasn't kidding. I remember the first time I visited. I was maybe 13. It was spring, many months past Christmas, and yet black Santas lined the windowsills. Paper cutouts of black Santas hung from the stairway banister. Black Santa candles adorned the dining room table. A black Santa oil painting hung above the mantel, which was itself lined with black Santa figurines. They had a black Santa Pez dispenser, purchased from Namibia. The light-up plastic black Santa that stood in their postage stamp front yard from Thanksgiving to New Year's spent the rest of the year proudly keeping watch in the corner of the guest bathroom, a bathroom with homemade black Santa wallpaper created with paint and a Santa-shaped sponge. In every room, save Radar's, their home was awash in black Santadom. Plaster and plastic and marble and clay and wood and resin and cloth. In total, Radar's parents owned more than 1,200 black Santas of various sorts. As a plaque beside their front door proclaimed, Radar's house was an officially registered Santa landmark, according to the Society for Christmas.
You just gotta tell her, man, I said.
You just gotta say, Angela, I really like you, but there's something you need to know. When we go to my house and hook up, we'll be watched by the 2,400 eyes of 1,200 black Santas. Radar ran a hand through his buzz cut and shook his head.
Yeah, I don't think I put it exactly like that, but I'll deal with it.
I headed off to government, Ben to an elective about video game design. I watched clocks through two more classes, and then finally the relief radiated out of my chest when I was finished. The end of each day like a dry run for our graduation, less than a month away. I went home. I ate two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches as an early dinner. I watched poker on TV. My parents came home at 6, hugged each other, and hugged me. We ate a macaroni casserole as a proper dinner. They asked me about school. They asked me about prom. They marveled at what a wonderful job they had done raising me. They told me about their days dealing with people who had been raised less brilliantly. They went to watch TV. I went to my room to check my email. I wrote a little bit about the Great Gatsby for English. I read some of the Federalist Papers as early prep for my government final. I IM'd with Ben, and then Radar came online. In our conversation, he used the phrase, the world's largest collection of black Santas, 4 times, and I laughed each time. I told him I was happy for him, having a girlfriend. He said it would be a great summer. I agreed. It was May 5th, but it didn't have to be. My days had a pleasant identicalness about them. I had always liked that.
I liked routine. I like being bored. I didn't want to, but I did. And so May 5th could have been any day until just before midnight, when Margot Roth Spiegelman slid open my screenless bedroom window for the first time since telling me to close it 9 years before. Chapter 2. I swiveled around when I heard the window open, and Margot's blue eyes were staring back at me. Her eyes were all I could see at first, but as my vision adjusted, I realized she was wearing black face paint and a black hoodie. "Are you having cyber sex?" she asked. "Am I IMing with Ben Starling?" "That doesn't answer my question, perv." I laughed awkwardly, then walked over and knelt by the window, my face inches from hers. I couldn't imagine why she was here, in my window like this. "To what do I owe the pleasure?" I asked. Margot and I were still friendly, I guess, but we weren't meet in the dead of night wearing black face paint friendly. She had friends for that, I'm sure. I just wasn't among them. "I need your car," she explained. "I don't have a car," I said, which was something of a sore point for me. "Well, I need your mom's car." "You have your own car," I pointed out. Margot puffed out her cheeks and sighed. "Right, but the thing is that my parents have taken the keys to my car and locked them inside a safe, which they put under their bed, and Myrna Mountweasel, who was her dog, is sleeping inside their room. And Myrna Mountweasel has a freaking aneurysm whenever she catches sight of me. I mean, I could totally sneak in there and steal the safe and crack it and get my keys out and drive away. But the thing is that it's not even worth trying because Myrna Mountweasel is just going to bark like crazy if I so much as crack open the door. So like I said, I need a car. Also, I need you to drive it because I have to do 11 things tonight, and at least 5 of them involve a getaway man." When I let my sight unfocus, she became nothing but eyes floating in the ether. And then I locked back on her, and I could see the outline of her face, the paint still wet against her skin, her cheekbones triangulating into her chin, her pitch-black lips barely turned to a smile. "Any felonies?" I asked. Said Margot. "Remind me if breaking and entering is a felony." "No," I answered firmly. "No, it's not a felony, or no, you won't help." "No, I won't help. Can't you enlist some of your underlings to drive you around?" Lacey and or Becca were always doing her bidding. "They're part of the problem, actually," Margot said. "What's the problem?" I asked. "There are 11 problems," she said somewhat impatiently. "No felonies," I said. "I swear to God that you will not be asked to commit a felony." And right then, the floodlights came on all around Margot's house. In one swift motion, she somersaulted through my window into my room and then rolled beneath my bed. Within seconds, her dad was standing on the patio outside.
"Margot!" he shouted. "I saw you!"
From beneath my bed, I heard a muffled, "Oh, Christ!" Margot scooted out from under the bed, stood up, walked to the window, and said,
"Come on, Dad, I'm just trying to have a chat with Quentin. You're always telling me what a fantastic influence he could be on me and everything."
"Just chatting with Quentin?"
"Yes."
"Then why are you wearing black face paint?"
Margot faltered for only the briefest moment.
"Dad, to answer that question would take hours of backstory, and I know that you're probably very tired, so just go back to..."
"In the house!"
he thundered.
"This minute!"
Margot grabbed hold of my shirt, whispered, "Back in a minute," in my ear, and then climbed out the window. As soon as she left, I grabbed my car keys from my desk. The keys are mine. The car, tragically, is not. On my 16th birthday, my parents gave me a very small gift, and I knew the moment they handed it to me that it was a car key, and I about peed myself, because they'd said over and over again that they couldn't afford to give me a car. But when they handed me the tiny wrapped box, I knew they'd been tricking me, that I was getting a car after all. I tore off the wrapping paper and popped open the little box. Indeed, it contained a key. Upon close inspection, it contained a Chrysler key, a key for a Chrysler minivan, the one and the same Chrysler minivan owned by my mother. "My present is a key to your car?" I asked my mom. "Tom," she said to my dad, "I told you he would get his hopes up."
"Well, don't blame me,"
my dad said. You're just sublimating your own frustration with my income.
Isn't that snap analysis a tad passive-aggressive?
My mother asked.
Aren't rhetorical accusations of passive aggression inherently passive-aggressive?
My dad responded, and they went on like that for a while. The long and short of it was this. I had access to the vehicular awesomeness that is a late-model Chrysler minivan, except for when my mom was driving it. And since she drove to work every morning, I could only use the car on weekends. Well, weekends and the middle of the goddamn night. It took Margot more than the promised minute to return to my window, but not much more. But in the time she was gone, I'd started to waffle again.
I've got school tomorrow, I told her.
Yeah, I know, Margot answered. There's school tomorrow and the day after that, and thinking about that too long could make a girl bonkers. So yeah, it's a school night. That's why we've got to get going, because we've got to be back by morning.
I don't know.
Q, she said. Q, darling. How long have we been dear friends? We're not friends, we're neighbors.
Oh, Christ, Q, am I not nice to you? Do I not order my various and sundry minions to be kind to you at school?
Uh-huh, I answered dubiously, although in point of fact, I had always figured it was Margot who had stopped Chuck Parson and his ilk from screwing with us. She blinked. She had even painted her eyelids.
Q, she said, we have to go.
And so I went. I slid out the window, and we ran along the side of my house, heads down, until we opened the doors of the minivan. Margot whispered not to close the doors. Too much noise. So, with the doors open, I put it in neutral, pushed off the cement with my foot, and then let the minivan roll down the driveway. We rolled slowly past a couple houses before I turned on the engine and the headlights. We closed the doors, and then I drove through the serpentine streets of Jefferson Park's endlessness, the houses all still new-looking and plastic, like a toy village housing tens of thousands of real people. Margot started talking.
The thing is, they don't even really care. They just feel like my exploits make them look bad. Just now, do you know what he said? He said, I don't care if you screw up your life, but don't embarrass us in front of the Jacobsons. They're our friends. It's ridiculous. And you have no idea how hard they've made it to get out of that goddamned house. You know how in prison escape movies they put bundled up clothes under the blankets to make it look like there's a person in there?
I nodded.
Yeah, well, Mom put a goddamned baby monitor in my room so she could hear my sleep breathing all night. So I just had to pay Ruthie $5 to sleep in my room, and then I put bundled up clothes in her room.
Ruthie is Margot's little sister.
It's Mission Impossible shit now. Used to be I could just sneak out like a regular goddamned American, just climb out the window and jump off the roof. But God, these days it's like living in a fascist dictatorship.
Are you gonna tell me where we're going?
Well, first we're going to Publix because for reasons I'll explain later, I need you to go grocery shopping for me, and then to Walmart.
What? We're just going to go on a grand tour of every commercial establishment in Central Florida? I asked.
Tonight, darling, we are going to right a lot of wrongs, and we are going to wrong some rights. The first shall be last. The last shall be first. The meek shall do some earth inheriting. But before we can radically reshape the world, we need to shop.
I pulled into the Publix then, the parking lot almost entirely empty, and parked.
Listen, she said, how much money do you have on you right now?
$0.00, I answered. I turned off the ignition and looked over at her. She wriggled a hand into a pocket of her tight, dark jeans and pulled out several $100 bills.
Fortunately, the good Lord has provided, she said. What the hell?
I asked.
Bat mitzvah money, bitch.
I'm not allowed to access the account, but I know my parents' password because they use Myrna Mount W3AZ3L for everything, so I made a withdrawal. I tried to blink away the awe, but she saw the way I was looking at her and smirked at me.
Basically, she said, this is going to be the best night of your life.
Chapter 3. The thing about Margot Roth Spiegelman is that really all I could ever do was let her talk, and then when she stopped talking, encourage her to go on, due to the facts that, one, I was incontestably in love with her, and, two, she was absolutely unprecedented in every way, And three, she never really asked me any questions, so the only way to avoid silence was to keep her talking. And so in the parking lot of Publix, she said, "So, right, I made you a list. If you have any questions, just call my cell. Listen, that reminds me. I took the liberty of putting some supplies in the back of the van earlier."
What, like before I agreed to all this?
Well, yes. Technically, yes. Anyway, just call me if you have any questions, but with the Vaseline, you want the one that's bigger than your fist. There's like a baby Vaseline, and then there's a mommy Vaseline, and then there's the big fat daddy of a Vaseline, and that's the one you want. If they don't have that, then get like three of the mommies.
She handed me the list and $100 bill and said, "That should cover it."
Margot's list. 3 whole catfish, wrapped separately. She had capitalized catfish and wrapped. Capital V, Veet, it's for capital S, shaving your legs, capital O, only you don't need, capital A, a razor. It's with all the capital G, girly cosmetic stuff. Vaseline, 6-pack, Mountain Dew, 1 dozen, capital T, tulips, 1, capital B, bottle of water, capital T, tissues, 1, capital C, can of blue spray paint.
"Interesting capitalization," I said.
"Yeah, I'm a big believer in random capitalization. The rules of capitalization are so unfair to words in the middle."
Now, I'm not sure what you're supposed to say to the checkout woman at 12:30 in the morning when you put 13 pounds of catfish, Veet, the fat daddy-sized tub of Vaseline, a 6-pack of Mountain Dew, a can of blue spray paint, and a dozen tulips on the conveyor belt. But here's what I said. "This isn't as weird as it looks." The woman cleared her throat, but didn't look up.
"Still weird," she muttered.
"I really don't want to get in any trouble," I told Margot back in the minivan as she used the bottled water to wipe the black paint off her face with the tissues. She had only needed the makeup, apparently, to get out of the house. "In my admission letter from Duke, it actually explicitly says that they won't take me if I get arrested."
"You're a very anxious person, Q."
"Let's just please not get in trouble," I said. "I mean, I want to have fun and everything, but not at the expense of, like, my future."
She looked up at me, her face mostly revealed now, and she smiled just the littlest bit.
"It amazes me that you can find all that shit even remotely interesting."
"Huh?"
"College, getting in or not getting in. Trouble, getting in or not getting in. School, getting A's or getting D's. Career, having or not having. House, big or small, owning or renting. Money, having or not having. It's all so boring."
I started to say something, to say that she obviously cared a little because she had good grades and was going to the University of Florida's honors program next year, but she just said, "Walmart." We entered Walmart together and picked up that thing from infomercials called the Club, which locks a car's steering wheel into place. As we walked through the juniors department, I asked Margot, "Why do we need the Club?" Margot managed to speak in her usual manic soliloquy without answering my question. "Did you know that for pretty much the entire history of the human species, the average lifespan was less than 30 years? You could count on 10 years or so of real adulthood, right? There was no planning for retirement. There was no planning for a career. There was no planning. No time for planning. No time for a future. But then the lifespan started getting longer, and people started having more and more future. And so they spent more time thinking about it, about the future. And now life has become the future. Every moment of your life is lived for the future. You go to high school so you can go to college, so you can get a good job, so you can get a nice house, so you can afford to send your kids to college, so they can get a good job, so they can get a nice house, so they can afford to send their kids to college." It felt like Margot was just rambling to avoid the question at hand, so I repeated it. "Why do we need the Club?" Margot patted me in the middle of the back softly.
"I mean, obviously this is all going to be revealed to you before the night is over."
And then, in boating supplies, Margot located an air horn. She took it out of the box and held it up in the air, and I said, "No." And she said,
"No what?"
And I said, "No, don't blow the air horn." Except when I got to about the B in blow, she squeezed on it, and it let out an excruciatingly loud honk that felt in my head like the auditory equivalent of an aneurysm. And then she said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. What was that?" And I said, "Stop bu-" And then she did it again. A Walmart employee, just a little older than us, walked up to us then and said, "Hey, you can't use that in here." And Margot said, with seeming sincerity, "Sorry, I didn't know that." And the guy said, "Oh, it's cool. I don't mind, actually." And then the conversation seemed over, except the guy could not stop looking at Margot, and honestly, I don't blame him, because she is hard to stop looking at. And then finally he said, "What are you guys up to tonight?" And Margot said, "Not much, you?" And he said, "I get off at 1, then I'm going out to this bar down on Orange if you want to come. But you'd have to drop off your brother. They're really strict about IDs." "Her what?" "I'm not her brother," I said, looking at the guy's sneakers. And then Margot proceeded to lie. "He's actually my cousin," she said. Then she sidled up to me, put her hand around my waist so that I could feel each of her fingers taut against my hip bone, and she added, "And my lover." The guy just rolled his eyes and walked away, and Margot's hand lingered for a minute, and I took the opportunity to put my arm around her. "You really are my favorite cousin," I told her. She smiled and bumped me softly with her hip, spinning out of my embrace. "Don't I know it," she said. Chapter 4. We were driving down a blessedly empty I-4, and I was following Margot's directions. The clock on the dashboard said it was 1:07. "It's pretty, huh?" she said. She was turned away from me, staring out the window, so I could hardly see her. "I love driving fast under streetlights." "Light," I said. "The visible reminder of invisible light." "That's beautiful," she said. "T.S. Eliot," I said. "You read it too, in English, last year." I hadn't actually ever read the whole poem that line was from, but a couple of the parts I did read got stuck in my head. "Oh, it's a quote," she said, a little disappointed. I saw her hand on the center console. I could have put my own hand on the center console, and then our hands would have been in the same place at the same time. But I didn't. "Say it again," she said. "Light, the visible reminder of invisible light." "Yeah. Damn, that's good. That must help with your lady friend." "Ex-lady friend," I corrected her. "Susie dumped you?" Margot asked. "How do you know she dumped me?" "Oh, sorry." "Although she did," I admitted, and Margot laughed. The breakup had happened months ago, but I didn't blame Margot for failing to pay attention to the world of lower caste romance. What happens in the band room stays in the band room. Margot put her feet up on the dashboard and wiggled her toes to the cadence of her speaking. She always talked like that, with this discernible rhythm like she was reciting poetry. "Right, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I can relate. My lovely boyfriend of lo these many months is fucking my best friend." I looked over, but her hair was all in her face, so I couldn't make out if she was kidding. "Seriously?" She didn't say anything. "But you were just laughing with him this morning. I saw you." "I don't know what you're talking about. I heard about it before first period, and then I found them both talking together, and I started screaming bloody murder, and Becca ran into the arms of Clint Bower, and Jace was just standing there like a dumbass with the chaw drool running out of his stank mouth." I had clearly misinterpreted the scene in the hallway. "That's weird, because Chuck Parson asked me this morning what I knew about you and Jace." "Yeah, well, Chuck does as he's told, I guess. Probably trying to find out for Jace who knew." "Jesus, why would he hook up with Becca?" "Well, she's not known for her personality or generosity of spirit, so it's probably because she's hot." "She's not as hot as you," I said before I could think better of it. "That's always seemed so ridiculous to me, that people would want to be around someone because they're pretty. It's like picking your breakfast cereals based on color instead of taste. Oh, it's the next exit, by the way. But I'm not pretty, not close up anyway. Generally, the closer people get to me, the less hot they find me." "That's..." I started. "Whatever," she answered. It struck me as somewhat unfair that an asshole like Jason Worthington would get to have sex with both Margot and Becca. when perfectly likable individuals such as myself don't get to have sex with either of them, or anyone else for that matter. That said, I like to think that I'm the type of person who wouldn't hook up with Becca Arrington. She may be hot, but she is also, one, aggressively vapid, and two, an absolute unadulterated raging bitch. Those of us who frequent the band room have long suspected that Becca maintains her lovely figure by eating nothing but the souls of kittens and the dreams of impoverished children. Becca does sort of suck, I said, trying to draw Margot back into the conversation.
Yeah,
she answered, looking out the passenger window, her hair reflecting oncoming streetlights. I thought for a second she might be crying, but she rallied quickly, pulling her hoodie up and taking the club out of the Walmart bag.
Well, this'll be fun at any rate, she said as she ripped open the club's packaging. May I ask where we're going yet?
Becca's, she answered. Uh-oh, I said as I pulled up to a stop sign. I put the minivan in park and started to tell Margot that I was taking her home.
No felonies, promise. We need to find Jace's car. Becca's street is the next one up on the right, but he wouldn't park his car on her street because her parents are home. Try the one after. That's the first thing.
Okay, I said, but then we go home.
No, then we move on to part 2 of 11.
Margot, this is a bad idea.
Just drive, she said.
And so I just did. We found Jace's Lexus 2 blocks down from Becca's street, parked in a cul-de-sac. Before I had even come to a complete stop, Margot jumped out of the minivan with the club in hand. She pulled open the Lexus's driver's side door, sat down in the seat, and proceeded to attach the club to Jace's steering wheel. Then she softly closed the door to the Lexus.
Dumb bastard never locks that car, she mumbled as she climbed back into the minivan.
She pocketed the key to the club. She reached over and tousled my hair.
Part 1, done. Now to Becca's house.
As I drove, Margot explained parts 2 and 3 to me.
That's quite brilliant, I said, even though inside I was bursting with a shimmering nervousness.
I turned onto Becca's street and parked 2 houses down from her McMansion. Margot crawled into the way back of the minivan and returned with a pair of binoculars and a digital camera. She looked through the binoculars first and then handed them to me. I could see a light on in the house's basement, but no movement. I was mostly surprised that the house even had a basement. You can't dig very deep before hitting water in most of Orlando. I reached into my pocket, grabbed my cell phone, and dialed the number that Margot recited to me. The phone rang once, twice, and then a groggy male voice answered.
Hello?
Mr. Arrington? I asked. Margot wanted me to call because no one would ever recognize my voice.
Who is this? God, what time is it?
Sir, I think you should know that your daughter is currently having sex with Jason Worthington in your basement. And then I hung up. Part 2, accompli. Margot and I threw open the doors of the minivan and charged down the street, diving onto our stomachs just behind the hedge ringing Becca's yard. Margot handed me the camera, and I watched as an upstairs bedroom light came on, and then a stairway light, and then the kitchen light, and finally the stairway down to the basement.
Here he comes,
Margot whispered, and I didn't know what she meant until, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a shirtless Jason Worthington wiggling out of the basement window. He took off sprinting across the lawn, naked but for his boxer shorts, and as he approached, I jumped up and took a picture of him, completing part 3. The flash surprised both of us, I think, and he blinked at me through the darkness for a white-hot moment before running off into the night. Margot tugged on my jeans leg. I looked down at her, and she was smiling goofily. I reached my hand down, helped her up, and then we raced back to the car. I was putting the key in the ignition when she said,
"Let me see the picture."
I handed her the camera, and we watched it come up on the screen together, our heads almost touching. Upon seeing the stunned, pale face of Jason Worthington, I couldn't help but laugh.
"Oh, God," Margot said and pointed.
In the rush of the moment, it seemed that Jason had been unable to get little Jason inside his boxers, and so there it was, hanging out, digitally captured for posterity.
"It's a penis," Margot said,
"in the same sense that Rhode Island is a state. It may have an illustrious history, but it sure isn't big."
I looked back at the house and noticed that the basement light was now off. I found myself feeling slightly bad for Jason. It wasn't his fault he had a micropenis and a brilliantly vindictive girlfriend. But then again, in sixth grade, Jace promised not to punch my arm if I ate a live earthworm. So I ate a live earthworm, and then he punched me in the face. So